How do we know that monkeys are even curious? Who established that?
I don't know.
Curious was, George.
Was it?
I don't know.
I'm just wondering, because like...
Or cats.
Right.
If I were to write a children's book, it would be...
Why did curiosity kill cats?
It would be curious raccoon. Curious raccoon, I think, is more accurate.
You know, raccoons are so cute. I want a raccoon so
Until they're in your garbage.
Oh, no, they're disgusting.
Yes.
But think of what animal was not disgusting.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
We domesticated.
Aren't they so cute and disgusting?
Well, like, I mean, have you ever looked at a raccoon with his little fingers and everything?
Yes, that's the appeal of the raccoon. It can look very innocent.
I'm just telling you, in heaven, where there will be animals, in heaven... We're going to be able to hang out with raccoons and sloths and raccoons and elephants, man. That's going to be at least 1,000 years.
I want to present an alternative, okay?
Better not be an alternative to animals in heaven.
No, to the raccoon. A more palatable animal that is...
palatable? I'm not eating raccoons.
An animal that is less trashy, let's say, but retains the cuteness of the raccoon.
Those trashy raccoons.
I call them more.
They're always drinking late.
Less trash divey. How about that?
Trash divey. Okay. Thank you. I present to you the red panda.
The red panda is a fantastic, fantastic animal.
It's like a fantastical creature. It doesn't look real. It's
so
cute.
Cool. It's so cool.
Yeah.
We have them in the zoo here.
They're the best.
So as you probably have already deduced, listener, this episode is about the Enlightenment. Welcome to 10,000 Places, the podcast where a theologian, a philosopher, and a campus minister go into a room and then go 10,000 places. My name is Alex Giltner.
I am Lewis Pearson.
And I am Justin Aquila.
And welcome to 10,000 Places.
So today we wanted to chat a little bit about, well, I'm going to present it this way. I've been a catechist for about 10 years and a teacher in various ways. And one of the catechist's main roles is to share with people and prepare people for the sacramental life. It's not their only job, but it's what we functionally do a lot in parishes. And it's increasingly hard to introduce people to a sacramental life because the word sacrament means it's a sign. And the way in our culture today, we perceive signs is very different from the ancient world from which the language of sacraments comes. The way we're kind of used to signs in one sense telling us what to do, traffic lights, literal stop signs, but also we're in the stew where the world of marketing and advertisement is constantly using signs and symbols to invite us or compel us to do...
Manipulate us.
I was being nice. Into extracting something from us, right?
Sorry.
Yeah, extracting particularly our money in exchange of goods and service. But that's not how the ancient world views signs. And part of this experience is mediated by an aspect of our history that we exist in the stew of ideas that was created by this period of time called the Enlightenment. And I would suggest that there's some tensions around the body of intellectual thought that came out of the Enlightenment right now. And we thought we'd want to unpack this a little bit for you listeners because, one, it affects the way we receive the faith, and two, it is part of the broader conversation in which we exist in politics, economics, how we view nature, and so on and so forth. So I'll kind of say this as the last kind of opening statement. There are tensions right now, deep tensions in the acceptance of the Enlightenment worldview. And we won't maybe know so much talk about these, but I just want to name them. One of them is from the Catholic Church. I think the Catholic Church has constantly stood against the Enlightenment, or at very least in tension with it. But also we see in movements like critical race theory, there's also a critique of the Enlightenment coming from a very different perspective. So as we kind of unpack this a little bit, I think it's going to be relevant both to our economics and politics. We might not get to all this in the show, but it is one of the things I think the three of us are somewhat concerned with and addressing.
And I think it seems that when you say there's a problem with the Enlightenment, from some people think that's crazy. Like, that's a crazy person talking.
Yeah, but if you know anything about the history of ideas, the Catholic Church has always had tensions with the Enlightenment. And then I would actually broaden critical race theory out to postmodernism. Are we going to define the Enlightenment later on? Okay,
yes.
So then I won't worry about that. So in this podcast, we don't just talk about a topic and then, well, we've got that one in the bag. I mean, like, when we talk about the Trinity, it's not like, that was our episode on the Trinity. We all get that one now. Okay. So, right. So our conversations are ongoing. And, you know, like, for example, just this conversation about signs. Someday we'll do a podcast on the Eucharist and what the ancient world means by sign and symbol and how sign does not mean commemoration like some people might interpret it to mean. But also, you know, this conversation about the Enlightenment, when this is framing probably a lot of the things that we might say, as Justin pointed out, about politics, about cultural conversations. So the Enlightenment is an ongoing conversation for us because while there has been a lot of tension, there's also been an ongoing dialogue between the Catholic Church and the Enlightenment.
Right.
So maybe it'd be good actually for our resident philosopher to actually tell us, what is the Enlightenment?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I want to start by talking about what I thought it was. And maybe you guys can help me to see why I was wrong about them. I said, it seems like a crazy person is going to say there's a problem with the Enlightenment. Like, what, you want us to be ignorant? And, you know, these feudal serfs left in the tyranny and oppression of the Dark Ages?
And I tell my students, yes, that is exactly what I want for you.
So this is the unexamined impression of history. And maybe it was more than an impression, but it seems like that's all it is because I didn't examine it. The impression I had was, well, the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages was just a bunch of people toiling away for greedy landowners that you might call noblemen or knights or kings or something. And then we have this thing called the Enlightenment that is this untrammeled good and helps.
Which was the narrative of the Enlightenment, actually.
Yeah.
And so, like, everybody's seeing Monty Python and the Holy Grail. This is an Enlightenment narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is an important point about the stew of ideas we live in. We just accept these kind of narratives.
Yeah. So I had this misguided picture of the Middle Ages and a misguided picture of the Enlightenment. I saw the Middle Ages as just clearly bad, Enlightenment clearly good. So the first time I heard someone criticize the Enlightenment, I thought, are you like an ignorant person or someone who wants power and so you want other people to be ignorant? It was just completely alien to me. And I start learning, this is because I was, like you said, Alex, under the Enlightenment picture. And I had no idea that this is a worldview that had so much influence the way I was seeing things. So it required me to start to examine it. So the place I started was this picture. And the picture was, I think in many ways, so this is not the picture I had. This is the picture I learned. The picture we have is we have an oppressive culture, an ignorant culture. We're going to go back to the sources of antiquity where we had art at a high degree of refinement. We had reasoning. We had literature that was talking about the human condition. And we're going to leave behind all this clerical stuff and the scholastic stuff and all these things that the church has mired us in with all their infighting and their wars. That was the picture that I got from the Enlightenment. The problem is, it's actually a result of the Protestant Reformation, I would say. And I'm not alone in this, right?
Oh, I'd agree.
What happens is we have...
I don't think the Protestants meant for this to happen.
No.
In the Reformation.
Right,
the Protestants,
right.
I'm not talking about Protestants today, obviously, but talking about historical Protestants of the Catholic Church
didn't
see this coming.
Right.
But I would say that given the sway and influence of the Catholic Church, the Catholic intellectual tradition, the Protestant Reformation completely opened up the world for this kind of thing called the Enlightenment, which has an ambivalent legacy. Good and bad.
Yeah. It's this attempt to reestablish a certain foundation for common discourse and culture. That's what it was. The church, which is in many ways the inventor of hospitals and universities and culture as we know it.
I wouldn't even say in many ways. I'd say pretty much the inventor.
Yeah. And the preserver of antiquity in its monasteries and its libraries, et cetera, et cetera. The church, which gives us up to the time of the Reformation, all of our scientists and our poets, and basically everyone who contributes to fine arts and culture, science, name it, it came from the church that created these institutions, preserved them, maintained them. All of a sudden, you have a group of people coming along that says the Catholic Church is an apostate church. It's not the true church anymore. The true church is over here. And so it's not just today we think, oh, religion's just whatever you want, so I go to this church down the road, not the church across the street. For them, if all these things came out of the church, and you're now saying the church isn't who she says she is. Well, she's behind everything. And so should I believe what she says about the solar system? Should I believe what she says about how language works? Should I say believe what she says about basically everything, right? And so when you have this fundamental upheaval are the foundation of all human pursuit, there has to be a way of reestablishing a common foundational discourse. Well, I'm not Catholic, but I still want to do this kind of human endeavor with you together. How are we going to do this? And the Enlightenment, one of the ways they did it, they said, well, let's just pretend like the church never existed, even though we all were formed by her and we're coming out of her institutions. And instead, kind of ad hoc, arbitrarily reestablish what we think our foundations are in antiquity before the church ever came into being. And so the Enlightenment was this, in some ways, well-meaning and certainly unintended consequence of the Reformation to establish a way for common discourse to flourish again. But the reason I think it has this bad edge to it is because, well, they thought, well, since people are having this disagreement about the church, let's just pretend like the last 1,500 years didn't happen.
Just real quick, to make a practical point on that, I think one of the, you see it even the method in which they're proposing, the major thinkers of the Enlightenment are proposing, so they go back and craft almost all of them what they call a state of nature. So they redefine what it means to be human because the prior story didn't fit the narrative anymore.
So the book of Genesis is part of the bone of contention. Well, the church says this is what it means for human beings, where did they come from? And now there's other people saying, no, this is what the book of Genesis means. And so say, no, no, let me tell you a story about where man comes from in his native state as the primitive man in a tribe. And they give these state of nature discourses as the, it's their new book of Genesis.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they start to attribute to the church things that the church never taught. The church has never taught anything about the earth's relation to the sun. Ever. There are people within the church who had ideas that were shared by everybody, but the church has never issued a teaching on the solar system.
Yeah.
The church has never issued a teaching on the shape of the world, which, by the way, no one ever thought was flat. Okay? Nobody ever thought the world was flat. Maybe like, you know, your average person who never really thought about it, like C.S. Lewis talks about in The Discarded Image, but like, if you watched a ship come over the horizon, you could tell the world was not flat because you'd see the mast coming and it wouldn't just come from afar and get bigger. It would come over the horizon.
A textual support for this?
Dante.
Yeah. Thomas Aquinas, Summa Theologiae, Prima Pars, question one. He's asking, why do we need sacred science, the study of scripture? We already have theology, pagan philosophy that tells us who God is. Even the pagans knew there was a God through reason alone. They didn't know the things that we know because of revelation. But he says in this question, in his reply to the objection, we already have theology from the philosophers. Why do we need sacred science from the theologians? And he says, well, just as there are many ways to know the earth's circumference, right, through astronomy and through, you can extrapolate it through trigonometry and you can know it through direct measurement. So too, there's many ways to come to know God. And the point of the Summa Theologiae was it's supposed to be a primer for priests to preach to their flock.
It was a beginner text.
And so the idea was, this is something everybody knows. He's trying to use a commonly understood thing.
Yeah.
It's not abstruse knowledge.
Oh, yeah. There were some Greek scholars who actually got within a few thousand miles of the actual circumference of the earth, like, what, 300-400 years before Christ. So, like, people knew this. And
yeah. And Thomas Aquinas, for the listeners, this is 1200s he's writing. And the Reformation doesn't happen until the 1500s.
And so, like, you know, for example, Dante, when they go down into Inferno and they get to the bottom of it, there's Satan, you know, he's stuck in the ice of his own tears. Dante's so brilliant. But he's stuck in the ice of his own tears and he's flapping his wings so fast that it cools his tears and holds him down. So he's keeping himself there, which is brilliant. But also, so he's huge. And so they start climbing down him on his hair.
Yeah.
And then, because he's like, you know, he's a beast and he's got hair all over him. And then suddenly they're climbing upward, because they'd cross the center point of the earth and then come out on the other side of the globe. Dante is clear as day about this. And nobody would have read that and said, what are you doing to me right now, Dante, you crazy, crazy schmuck? No, they knew it. Copernicus did the same kind of things to prove that the sun was the center of the universe, heliocentric, which Galileo also thought, and it wasn't until a lot of other things happened. But nobody cared. Nobody cared about Copernicus. Like, they thought it was knowledge, but the church didn't get upset.
They didn't care until the Reformation made people wonder, oh, you're saying weird things. Maybe you're not the true church.
Right. And when Galileo did it, he did it with a very argumentative spirit in mind. Now, I'm not trying to talk about whether or not what happened to Galileo was right or wrong. I don't care. What I'm saying is that, like, this narrative was invented by the Enlightenment. So it's not like... What I want to clarify is it's not like the Enlightenment people were like right that the church had been suppressing all this knowledge and stuff. But they ascribe to the church things that the church never actually said. They ascribe to the church things that no one ever said. No one said the world was flat. Flat earthers didn't exist until like the last 100 years.
I think, too, it might be helpful to flush out a few of these practical ways we live in this stew of ideas and maybe not explore them fully. That's for the future. But I think one of them that always strikes out to me, and I owe this to Pope Francis for the way he set it up in Laudato Si, was, and I think John Paul's Theology of the Body is critiquing this too, one of the primary Enlightenment ideas is that mankind is meant to have control over nature or power over nature. So the body then just becomes a machine. I think it's the famous quote from Francis Bacon that we must put nature on the torture rack and extract her secrets from her. So that it becomes, we begin to reduce the world around us to this mechanistic view.
And I add to that then, they start to see man, humans, as this kind of animal who has otherwise been entrapped in nature by society. And so Rousseau comes along and says, you know, man was born free, but now he is everywhere in chains.
And we must, and Rousseau goes, we must force him to be free.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And so we have to put nature back in its place. Yep. We need to rip her secrets out so that we can actualize ourselves. I mean, you think about going back to Genesis. We're supposed to steward. You know, dominance in that passage is not dominance like do whatever you want to it. It's dominance like God dominates, which is helping grow, helping flourish, this and that. No.
So Genesis asks for the stewardship. Rousseau asks for something else.
Right. And Bacon asks for something else. And so when, you know, most famously, we have to mention at least Descartes, which is sometimes seen as, you know, the progenitor of the Enlightenment, although, you know, that's for scholars to contest.
Descartes comes before the horse? I went there.
Oh.
we're going to try to...
We need some radio sounds.
And we're back!
Edit that out.
I know. Actually, I think it was good. Keep it in. I want everybody to see what a dork you are. but anyway,
I only know the punchline of that joke, put Descartes. I don't know the joke.
I don't know how the joke
I don't know.
Yeah,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you
yeah,
can't
yeah,
put
yeah.
Descartes before the horse. But anyway.
Or the joke either. So
yeah. But anyway, so René Descartes was a French thinker in the first half of the 17th century. And to his defense, like he, you know, you're talking about trying to find this stable thing that we can all. Well, after the Protestant Reformation happens, then, of course, there's warring everywhere over who's going to control society because church and state separation didn't happen for a while. And what René Descartes grew up in was the 30 Years' War. Most of his entire life had been during a period where if you were Catholic in Protestant territory, you might not wake up. People might come in the night and slit your throats and vice versa. And so people
and he served in the army.
Right. People are killing each other over these things, which I don't want to support the war of religions myth either. But like there was literal things going on. And so a discourse on method comes out 1637, something like it's like 4 years after the end of the 30 Years' War. So he's trying to level the playing field, clean everything up so we can have a dialogue without having to bring religious sensibilities into it and all that politics and everything, because they weren't really wars about religion. They were wars about politics.
Yeah, it was about confiscating church property, which princes have what jurisdiction in what countries. That's what it was really about.
Right. The Protestant Reformation, this is, I'm sorry if this seems combative, but honestly, I mean, I love our Protestant brothers and sisters, but they would not be here if the German Fürsten or the princes of Germany had not backed them.
Yeah, I think it's just a quick point.
And they backed them because they wanted free from the
political.
They didn't
care about the theological positions.
Right, right. They wanted the power and they saw the moment to seize it.
Yeah, I think it just is an invitation to dialogue to someone who is Protestant. Just as John Paul II has acknowledged the past Catholic offenses, shall we say, I think it is important for the healing of at least the Western world that our Protestant brothers and sisters do the same with their history. Yeah.
So then suddenly, out of this, like, and I think people also don't understand because church and state separation and then private and public secular worldview is so inundated because of how successful the Enlightenment was. We do not understand what a social cataclysmic catastrophe the Reformation was, how much it upended society, a society that had been established for at least 1,000 years.
Yeah. And there's something
Like, the pandemic has nothing on the Reformation.
Oh, to have lived in those times, it would have been amazing in terms of the upheaval. And there's something, dishonest gives the wrong connotation, but I think the right sense. There's something dishonest about pretending like we're not formed by our history and our upbringing. We're just going to arbitrarily assume a new establishment for how we think and why we think what we do. And so I think that kind of schizophrenia, it's difficult to get away from. And when I started learning as an adult, this is what people mean when they talk about the problems of the Enlightenment. There's nothing wrong with, my area of expertise in philosophy is the ancient world. There's nothing wrong with their art, their philosophy, their culture. But there's something odd in saying, well, we're jumping from the year, I don't know, let's say 100 BC to the year 1600. And I think so many of the things we do are like that. We don't realize what we've been given and how we've been formed, because when we are formed this way, in the very act of rebellion, we're actually utilizing the thing that we're trying to distance ourselves from. Descartes, for instance, who's trying to reestablish common discourse on the basis of inward reflection, knowing that I exist because I'm a thing that can think and doubt. He's actually basing this argument on metaphysical categories that he gets from the scholastic era of the Middle Ages.
Or
so the highlight, the scholastic era would be the, we would say, the kind of crowning achievement of Catholic thought.
Yeah, Bonaventure, Thomas would be the big lights there. But also, he's not even just taking it from the scholastics. He straight up lifts Augustine's argument from Contra Academicos.
And on the Trinity. So Augustine, who writes...
He says, sum...
Cogito ergo sum?
No, that's Descartes.
That's Descartes, sorry.
He says, fallor ergo sum. If I err, then I am.
Yeah, the fact that I can be wrong about what I'm thinking, even if I'm only in a dream, I know that I must be a thing that's dreaming. And so I must exist as a thing that can be fooled and doubt. And he writes this...
That's also, Augustine's position?
That's Augustine.
Yeah.
In the 300 to 400s, and he's writing this in on the Trinity and against the academicians. And yeah, Descartes just takes that in the 1600s, the very same argument. But
he changes it to cogito ergo sum, which for our listeners means I think, therefore I am. You've certainly heard that one.
Yeah. And when he explains it further...
Let's hope.
Yeah.
When he explains it further, Descartes, in his supplement to cogito ergo sum, he explains Augustine's argument. He just uses it over again, that even if I'm doubting something, I'm a thing that has a doubt, and so
I
must
exist. Does
he
give Augustine credit, though?
Well, you know, they didn't really do that kind of thing back
then.
Yeah.
It's just interesting that, because it's actually a fine argument when it's not taken to be the basis of all knowledge itself. Like, that's the difference, is Augustine didn't mean this to be the basis of all knowledge. He just meant it to be the basis of my own expression an experience of existence itself, meaning that I can interact with a real world outside of me. Descartes flips it and says, no, my internal world is the way in which I understand that the world is and how I understand that it is. And so this is what if you want to get, you know, super technical, what's called in philosophy the turn to the subject, away from the objective and towards the subjective. And that sets up, interestingly enough, the Enlightenment there is setting up in that movement the later critiques that are going to come from postmodernism.
Play that out for us. How does that affect our everyday life? How does that affect the way we think today in the 21st
century? Do you want to take this one, Lewis?
Sure, yeah. Many philosophers would characterize the modern era as the era that had a quest for certainty. We want to know something for certain that can be the foundation on which we build our common discourse. And so it was a kind of a foundationalist worldview of how epistemology, the study of knowledge, how we can know things and then talk together about what we know. And it looks by the time that the so-called modern era is over, and for philosophers, modern era means like 1600s to 1800s, and then the contemporary era begins after that. And in literary circles, they don't call it the contemporary era, they call it the postmodern era. If the modern era was this quest for certainty, and by the time it's all said and done, we can't find anything that's ungainsayable, meaning no matter what you start with, it looks like it's not going to work. Someone can doubt it, or it can't bear the burden you want it to bear as a foundation. People just give up the ghost. They think, well, we tried to find a new foundation. At this point, they've already forgotten that they left behind the entire patrimony that got them to that point. All we can really say is that there is no foundation. And so postmodernity is, in a sense, the despairing of certainty. And so all you have now, as opposed to a quest for a common foundation, you have people sitting at a common table. It's a cacophony, but it's basically just managing people at a table who are all talking at once.
And so to put it more into the practical terms, basically, when the Enlightenment says that the basic foundation of certainty is not existence, like Augustine's saying, or like the tradition says, being, that there is something going on. But when you say it's not the world out there that confirms existence, it's the world in here. I'm pointing to my head, listeners. It's the world in my subjective reality that founds and secures all this. Well, now you've become the arbiter of reality within yourself. You have become the one who decides what's real and what's not because you've put it in yourself. Well, contrary to what many people think, there are other selves besides them.
That's also the definition of God, that you're the one that decides
what is real. Right, and so now you realize, well, other people have different experiences and different subjective realities within them. And so now there is no certainty because I'm not the only subject. And so subjectivism is what follows. And these are all brushstroke terms. Obviously, the history, even the Enlightenment is more than just one simple movement. But this is kind of these general kind of themes and zeitgeist that are kind of flowing through in these milieus. And so what happens basically is as the person becomes the single subjective person becomes the arbiter of reality, and that starts to happen to everyone, then suddenly everybody's experience and statement is equal. And now you've laid the groundwork for relativism, which is postmodern in many ways, even though it had been around forever, because what you've said is there is no certainty. There's only my subjective reality amongst all the other subjective realities. And so the Enlightenment, to finish up like what I meant by that comment, was the Enlightenment, while trying to find certainty, set the stage for certainty to break down almost definitively. And that leads us with what? Well, go relativists, or maybe consider the tradition.
Yeah.
Or violence.
Well, that's, relativism always ends up in power plays.
Right.
It sounds empowering. I get to decide what counts, but it's really ghettoizing. My value is now isolated only to the boundaries of my own skin. So everyone gets to decide what counts as good or bad. I get to decide what it means to be a good father, a good teacher. Mm-hmm. But then my students might say, but I don't think that's what it means. And my kids might think, I don't think that's what it means. So even though it sounds empowering, everyone gets to say what counts as meaning. It's actually isolating. No one gets to say how we actually connect because everyone is a kingdom in their own little isolated boundaries.
Right. And the Enlightenment lays the foundation for this by saying, man doesn't have a nature. He's master of nature. Creation is something to be taken apart, which includes his body, because he's just this ethereal soul floating, a mind with ideas.
And both of those are about power.
Right.
Yep.
And then he, within his own self, is the arbiter of all reality, or she. And so each person then becomes this unmoored, unbodied, uncreated, unnatural thing that exists within these playgrounds and machines and can do whatever they want to self-actualize. And I mean, if we can't see where that goes.
Yeah. So I think part of the problem is this. When we're under this worldview, we think that we can be self-determined realities. And so we are blind to the fact that most of what we have is given to us. We didn't invent our language. We were given our language. We didn't have a choice, right? We didn't have a choice over being given life. We were born, which is why Chesterton—
No, I caused my own birth.
Yeah, this isn't the time travel grandfather paradox episode, is it? Chesterton says the reason he loves birthdays is because they're so gratuitous. We celebrate something for a person when the person had nothing to contribute to it, right? So the birthday, we didn't have our life. Our parents decided for us what language we're going to speak. Like, we think, well, I'm going to let my kid decide. No, you're not. Like, if you wait for the kid to decide what language he wants to speak, he's never going to speak. We talk this way about like religions and stuff. Like, you give the kid what the kid needs to flourish, which includes life, which includes language, which includes how to walk, the way of life. But this is what religion is about. To say you don't give him a religion is actually like saying I'm not going to give him a language. And so what happens is when we get old enough to use these things, we're not even aware that the air we breathe, that these are things that we are relying on. They're not self-determined. And this is actually tropologically a picture of what happens with the Tower of Babel.
What do you mean by tropologic?
So a trope, right? It's like a historical foreshadowing. Like this event happens in history and some of the historical events we read in the Bible, they're foreshadowing. They are pre-images of something that happens later on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we know what this is. This is the Tower of Babel. So we had this sure, firm foundation in God. And we think, well, I don't want that one, right? I want to make my own.
I want to build a tower into the sky.
So all these people work together on this common project. And what happens is God says, no, this is not true certainty. You're not going to get what you want. And so he scatters the people and their languages are dispersed as well. This is what happens when you go from the common discourse and culture that the church was shepherding to the modern quest for certainty, the building of this tower, to the postmodern scattering of the languages, right? We have this history. And the reason I think the Enlightenment has this double edge to it, it's good and bad, is because we're fallen human beings. Insofar as we've been created for God, we are good. But insofar as we're abusing what he gave us.
Lewis, you mentioned, as we wrap up, you mentioned G.K. Chesterton, and I want to propose him as a way for Catholics or someone who is struggling to understand what it is the Catholic Church is proposing that's in tension with what they might have been raised to understand about, consciously or unconsciously, about history, about politics, about economics, about the view of nature. Chesterton has this beautiful way, and he does it in so many different, there's so many different examples we could use to illustrate this, but it feels like we're trapped in an A-B world where I have to believe A or B. I have to believe the Republicans or the Democrats, the liberals or the conservatives, the Protestants or the Catholics, et cetera, or the atheists or the...
And the progressives or the traditionalists or the...
We could go on and on. And what Chesterton's like, no, there's a C option. And I think the church offers that, the Catholic Church. I think it offers a way out of this. We just have to be able to see it as such. And one of the challenges for many Catholics is that we talked about this when we talked about it, the challenge of being American and Catholic in some ways. In a prior episode, we live in a predominantly Enlightenment-formed culture with rebellions coming from a postmodernism, and we sometimes err on the side of conserving the Enlightenment. And that's where conservatism is in the United States. It's fundamentally driven by conserving Enlightenment ideas, not the practices and traditions of the Catholic Church.
Which is so funny because that's not what the original conservatives wanted to conserve.
Right.
In fact, they were rebelling against the Enlightenment.
Right.
Because they wanted to conserve the deeper Western tradition.
Yep.
That was formed on ideas like not that man was born free and now he's everywhere in chains and he needs to become master of the universe. The human being is a rational creature from God, put into a creation that was given its reality from God, by God, for the good. And that he has a freedom, the human being, to seek the good, and that all of society should be ordered towards creating that freedom to do so, which is the counter narrative of the conservatives, who also tended to be the romantics, like Wordsworth and Coleridge.
So the Enlightenment era was followed by romanticism as a cultural movement.
Right.
These romantics, yeah.
And then, of course, like the big hitter, Burke, Edmund Burke.
Edmund Burke, yeah.
Yeah. The conservative was meant to guard against the Enlightenment's dismantling of the Western tradition. And now it has become serving a lot of Enlightenment values,
right,
which were precisely what the early conservatives were worried about. They saw that what liberalism of their time, which was the total freedom in ideas, bound to nothing, just the Rousseauian, let's get all the chains of ideas off and just do our own thing. They saw that danger, and they saw these things coming with what we now call conservative and liberal, which looked nothing like them, those two positions, but were set, the table was set for them.
And it's interesting when you ask about like liberal versus conservative, this is why a more nuanced conversation is helpful. When you talk about conservative, your point is, what are you conserving?
Right.
That will define what you mean by this particular movement in a particular culture in a particular age.
And when you say you're liberal, what are you free from?
Yeah.
Right.
Are you free from something that you see as an unjust fetter? Or is what you're trying to free yourself from something that's actually holding things together and not letting them spill away?
And so like we go back to curiositas, which is a vice in the medieval and ancient world. It means to just seek indiscriminate knowledge without any formation, without any intention, and without any guard against bad knowledge, because as if knowledge is all equal.
Yeah.
Then it pits it against obediencia, to be obedient to your tradition, to your family.
To reality.
To reality, to your people. And now we've got to choose one or the other. Are we going to be obedient conservatives? Or are we going to be curious liberals? And however you want.
And like if one of those sounds more attractive to me, it's actually, if I stop and analyze it, indicative to me of my formation, not of the thing in itself.
Right. Whereas the one thing that I think ties this whole thing together that we haven't been talking about very much in this episode is the Catholic Church and the Catholic intellectual tradition, which says curiosity is satisfied through obedience.
Hmm.
And obedience breeds good knowledge seeking.
Yep. David Brooks, the writer from the New York Times, has a great line. He said, life is not about, it's not about freeing oneself from constraints. I'm paraphrasing here, but it's not about freeing oneself from constraints, but by choosing the right ones.
Hmm. Absolutely.
So we would say in the Christian tradition, in the ancient worldview, we are seeking liberation from the way God liberated the Israelites from slavery in Egypt, that which is truly oppressive, from sin, from evil, and so on and so forth. We don't want liberation from reality, though, because that unmoors us.
Right. We don't want...
That's an impossible dream.
Right.
It doesn't give us what we really want either.
We don't want liberation from difference in race or sex or environment or background. We want liberation from oppressive views like racism.
Right.
Or misogyny.
Right.
But the answer to that is not let's deconstruct all of those categories and break them down so that they're meaningless, except when I really feel like I'm one of them. And so this is why you cannot call this Catholic position conservative or liberal.
Right.
It breaks these dichotomous chains, exactly like Chesterton says, which is what makes him able to say all these ridiculously interesting axioms that he comes up with that seem to turn everything on its head.
I think maybe to give one specific example here near the end, I like the way that we've been talking about the broad categories of worldview that are informing concerns
people
have about
this. One of these times we're
going
to have an episode on worldview.
Yeah. What does it look like with a specific thing? You mentioned curiositas. So that also struck me when I started learning that it was considered a vice, but today it's just considered an unmitigated virtue.
Curious George.
Yeah.
He was a good monkey and curious.
But also curious. But curious. That's curious. How I read it for my kids. Yeah. Good little monkey, but always curious. And I learned it often, most clearly for me, reading Bernard of Clairvaux's The 12 Steps of Humility. So what is curiositas as a vice? What does this look like? Well, let's say you want to look something up because you need it for work or something important, right? And so you turn on your device, you Google it, and you see a little hyperlink to it. Oh, I've forgotten about Paul McCartney. Is he still alive? And you click on that, right? And just, oh, he's got this new album. I didn't know that. And you click on that. And then you click on another thing, and you click on another thing. And then 40 clicks and 20 minutes later, you don't remember what you were doing, but you did waste 20 minutes with cotton candy. Like, you don't even remember what you just looked at, right? This is curiositas. It is something
it is
I think we can...
waking up from the hyperlink dream saying, who am I and where have I been? What was I doing?
Yeah.
So where did the last 30 minutes go?
Yeah, our modern technology, I think, has helped to make very clear, we know what we're doing when we just spent an hour on YouTube instead of getting back to our job because it was just going to be 5 minutes, another 5 minutes, another 5 minutes. This is curiositas. I wonder what that is. Right? You keep clicking on these new things. But traditionally, we've already seen this in things like gossip. I just want to know. Like, no, gossip is a kind of illicit knowing because it's not the kind of thing that you can... I didn't learn it from your face. I learned it behind your back, and I learned it about you, and you don't know I learned it about you, so I can't tell you that I know it. We care about things that aren't really intrinsically worthy of our concern. We should be living our lives and doing the things instead of clicking and clicking and clicking, right? As I'm clicking, I have students who are waiting on me. I have kids who want me to play with them. But no, I need to watch another SNL clip with more cowbell, right? That's so that's what they got at curiositas. And I think when you explain it to someone, they think, oh, that's what you mean when you think curiosity. In that sense, I can see how it is a distraction, not an inducement. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't actually lead to knowledge that builds a life. It distracts from a life.
I have this image in my mind of The Office. Jim comes back from his time in, not Scranton, but the other...
In Connecticut.
Yeah.
Utica
and,
or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. And then he sees Kelly Kapoor again, and he says, hey, Kelly, how's it been? And she said, oh my gosh, Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes had a baby, and they named it Suri, and then Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie had a baby and named it, I don't know, like Succotash or Frankenstein or something. And he says, okay, but like, what's been up with you? How are you? And she goes, I just told you. That's what curiosity is.
Yeah.
It's all this knowledge about things that don't matter.
mm-hmm.
that don't lead
at to best, they don't matter.
Right.
At worst, they make us these pernicious gossips who care about things in other people's spiritual lives that
make no difference. And it's
they lead us to resentment. They lead us to envy. They lead to all kinds of things that aren't connecting us in love with neighbor.
And they assume that knowledge belongs to us simply because it's knowledge. And so the propriety of the Catholic intellectual tradition is, it is not for you to know the times and dates, the seasons, the kairos and chronos. Okay? You do what you're told. What is it to you if I'm going to martyr Peter this way?
Yeah. And this is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
This is curiositas.
Boom. I think again, we want to always return to the scriptural worldview and what it proposes for us and our human flourishing.
Amen.
And I always think of Paul's letter to the Philippians, chapter 4. Have no anxiety at all, but in everything by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, make your requests known to God. Then the peace of God that surpasses all understanding will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Finally, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence, and if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. As we wrap up here, we invite you to continue to think on these things with us as we go 10,000 places. I'm Justin Aquila.
I'm Lewis Pearson.
And I'm Alex Giltner. Thank you for joining us, and have a blessed week.
This show is a production of the Spoke Street Media Podcast Network. For more great podcasts, visit SpokeStreet.com.